Stephen Esposito is the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest. On Wednesday, somebody was asking Terry Savage about bonds and T-bills and I-bonds. And Stephen, maybe you and I should talk about that today, because bonds are doing pretty well, right?
Good afternoon. Yeah, actually, the market's rallying today on the bond market. Surprising, despite the a little higher than expected inflation on the wholesale side. So that's actually a nice surprise, seeing interest rates drop, maybe because they've ran up so much recently. But I think that's a good sign. The market, at least today, it is. We'll see tomorrow.
Well, so what's going on today, though? I mean, read into that a little bit for us.
And you know, I'm thinking maybe I think what maybe affected the markets here is the talk that. There's some stories out there that they're going to delay the tariffs that have been announced till April 1st, giving everybody a chance to negotiate and and figure out what they're going to do. I think that may be the overriding factor why bonds are rallying today. In fact, the tariffs get settled, really not being deployed much as people are feared. So if that happens, that'll be very positive for the market across the board. But I think the America First policy is starting to resonate with a lot of investors going forward. And I think if that continues and it turns out to be what we hope it does, the market could see a lot higher ground in the future.
So what number are we looking at? What's the rate for bonds right now?
Well, you got the yields are down on 4.2, 4.3 on the, I don't have it exactly in front of me right now, on the short-term paper.
Yeah.
You're 4.3 on the two-year, and I think we're at 4.55, something like that on the 10-year. And you've got a normalized yield curve. One thing we had a problem with for the last 20 months was the inverted yield curve. And now the yield curve is normalizing, which I think is positive all the way around for the bond market, for the banks, et cetera, and for the consumers. So I think that's all positive. But the fear out there, which is being really ignored today, is will the Fed actually raise rates out there? And that's a scary question. If they were to do that going forward,
you're the first person to bring that up here now in a very long time. Walk me through that.
Well, that's just obviously the bantering back and forth on all the business channels talking about some people are advocating the Fed not only not pause, but maybe potentially raise because of the numbers we just received today. I think that's a little premature going forward. I don't think the Fed needs to. I think I'd like to see him drop the short rates another 50 basis points, but that may be delayed till maybe 4th of July type area, I would say.
So,
we're doing well with them where they're at now, so there's no need to rock the boat, so to speak.
Yeah, well, that would. I mean, the conversation has always been how many rate drops, 1, 2, 3, and lately people have been saying 3, 2, 1, 0, now maybe go the other way. And is that because of this inflation number?
Yeah, I think it is, but I think it may be arbitrary right now. I think going forward that you'll see some better numbers as we go. But a lot of the fear out there is, you know, when you're fear of tariffs, you have a tendency to go in and buy. A lot of companies while they're buying as much as they can before the tariffs come in. So that could be affecting some of the numbers short term. Just the fear of it can, you know, yelling fire in a crowded theater, so to speak, can have an effect.
Tariffs.
So that
well,
could be what it is. I don't know.
One of our listeners, though, yesterday also asked Terry Savage. It was somebody who was in their 60s, and they said that they are worried enough about the turmoil in the world, either the next 4 years of tariffs in the Trump administration or war in Gaza, whatever, that they thought, you know what, I'm going to take stuff off the table. The person said, it's everything I can to keep from taking my money out of the market and burying it in the backyard. And then the question was, should I just get T-bills or I-bonds? And Terry didn't dissuade them from it. She said, you know what, 4%, 4+%, if you can live with that number, is not such a terrible idea. You might miss an upside, but she certainly understood the ill ease some people have. Anyway, what's your reaction to all that, Stephen?
Well, like if you're in your 60s and you're either at retirement or in retirement, having a large portion of your money in a very safe vehicle like money markets, et cetera, that's not a bad place. And as she pointed out, if you can make it at that rate of interest, you have enough funds to do that, then that's fine for you. You don't want to lose sleep, and you want peace of mind in retirement. So that's something you've got to look at. Depends on my portfolios. They're everywhere. We have every client's different, and we treat them accordingly. So, yeah, we have a lot of money sitting in money markets, but or deploying more capital into those companies that with dividends, where I think there'll be some growth. I do think I'm not afraid of what's coming out of Washington at all. I do think that focusing on America and reducing our debt, if that's possible, our expenditures would be a good thing. If we can actually tackle that and accomplish it. But I think America is still the best place in the world to invest. It's the safest place, and the world needs America to be stable. So I do think we have portfolios. We're continuing to add portfolios as more capital comes in from our clients. And but we do have a portion of it sitting in money market. It just depends on the client. For that client, it could be accurate. And again, if you're going to lose sleep, what's the point?
What equities are you putting money in? Do you like utilities? Do you like healthcare? Where do you go?
I'm a contrarian, always have been. I'm looking at, we own a lot of banks and have for the last couple of years since the banking crisis 2 years ago. We continue to hold those. I think there'll be a lot more M&A going forward with the new regime, the new administration.
Yeah.
I think you'll see a lot more companies deploying capital. If we can keep taxes down and not raise taxes, I think that'll unleash a lot more. We're hearing a lot more commentary about CEOs are more excited about the future and positive. So all those factors combined. So we're sticking with a lot of domestic-based companies. I think U.S. autos are cheap here because it is going to be U.S. auto-focused going forward.
Yeah.
Many of the healthcare stocks are cheap over fears of what might happen, and they're priced pretty cheap, but we're all getting older. So we're in a lot of consumer cyclicals. I think the consumer will do well. We just got to get over this little hump here, I think, and get clear as to the inflation side of it and the Fed. And I think by 4th of July is my guess we'll have a lot more clarity which way things are going, and I think rates could actually start to drop at that point further. So if that scenario pans out, then we'll be in a really good place in the second half of the year.
Stephen Esposito is the president of Yellowstone Wealth Management in Lake Forest. YellowstoneWM.com. Thanks, Stephen. Let's talk again.
Thank you. Take care.
Harris Briefowler. She is a senior writer over at CNET. Hi, Bree.
Hi. Happy to be with you.
Let's not talk about Elon Musk the whole time.
It's tough. I feel like he kind of dominates the tech news cycle these days.
He dominates them all. But there is an interesting tech story about him, and that is the profitability of OpenAI. Where is that story?
Well, OpenAI is in the process of trying to change from a nonprofit lab to a for-profit company, and Elon Musk and some of his investor buddies are not particularly happy about that. And they have made a bid to buy the company for $97.4 billion, and the company is not having it.
They don't want $97 billion. They lose control of their product then, of course. But wow, that's hard to walk away from. What's the thrust of this? It's Elon wants to buy it because of he sees it as competitive with him if it turns into a for-profit?
Sure. I mean, in ChatGPT, OpenAI, they kind of dominate the market right now. So it would make sense to acquire them and, you know, take over that, you know, number one spot in the AI market. But there's also been this long running feud between Sam Altman and Elon Musk over OpenAI. They started the company together back in 2015, and there was some competition over who should lead it, and Musk left the board in 2018.
Why do I care if one company is a for-profit and the other isn't? I'm not paying unless you're doing the premium subscription, but I mean, if you want artificial intelligence on your phone, you don't have to pay for it. What do I care about this?
Well, I mean, there are companies that license OpenAI. They use it as part of their operations. OpenAI, you know, they've just gotten so big, and ChatGPT has become huge, and all of this takes processing power and servers and just, you know, horsepower that costs money, also a lot of energy. So, you know, if they can switch to a for-profit company, they stand to make a lot of money, but you got to spend money to make money too.
Yeah, right. But you understand that's on them. The app would still be that would still be free to me. I'm not unconcerned about the environmental impact of these things. Who knew that that thing on your phone is consuming massive amounts of electricity, and a lot of that is carbon-based. But the gadget on my phone or on my laptop still works. I'm not going to have to pay for it, am I?
No, probably not. Although they, you know, a company can change its business model and how it works if it wants to. I mean, you know, look at Netflix. That used to be less than $10, and I just got another notice from them that they're raising my subscription rates again. So, you know, businesses do what they want to make money.
Do you do ad-supported streaming services?
I do for Hulu and Disney because that's what I get for free, and I'm used to it, but I started Netflix when it was ad-free, and I really don't see myself going back to that.
So what are you at, $17 a month then, something like that?
I think it's 25,
that's
and
right.
I think it might be going up again. Yeah, because I have a Ultra HD TV and kids with devices and things like that, and in order to do that, you kind of have to go for the high-end plan.
Okay, so 25 a month, and then how many other services do you have?
Oh, well, Hulu and Disney are free, and ESPN, of course. That's all free. But then what else? Stars, HBO, I let lapse. So I recommend that everybody go through and audit their streaming services every once in a while. And, you know, you really have to think, especially when they're raising rates, do you really need it?
There's a guy here in Chicago that does that. He comes on our show frequently, on this show, in fact, the Business Lunch. And for a small amount of money, he will go through your bills, your platforms. He finds that a lot of people have multiple subscriptions to the same service and don't even realize it.
Oh, sure. And you know what? I actually had that happen with Hulu because my husband logged in separately and ended up starting a new account, and I got a bill. But, you know, if you call them, they'll actually make that go away. So things that, you know, if you just put a little effort in, you can definitely get fixed.
What's the SpaceX story today?
Yeah, SpaceX wants to create its own town. They, a Texas judge has approved a plan for an election to be held in this area of Texas where SpaceX is based. They want to basically create a company town if the residents approve it, and the new city would be called Starbase. The election is set for May 3rd, and only people who live in the area will be able to vote.
That sounds kind of crazy, but municipalities pop up now and again. I mean, is what... talk a little bit more about that. Is that an area of concern? Is it novel? What are the consequences of that?
Well, honestly, it's kind of old school because you think back in the day, you know, the big industrial robber barons, they would create companies.
Right, but the legacy of those, but the legacy of those is negative. So that,
yeah, definitely. But at the same time, you know, this is kind of an unincorporated area along the U.S.-Mexico border. 70 residents signed a petition, and apparently, you know, 3,400 full-time employees that live there, about 100 kids. I don't know if they have city water, you know, things like that. You know, maybe if you're used to a well and they're going to bring in a water line for you and pay for it, seems awful enticing. It's easier to get those kinds of amenities if you're an incorporated city.
One last thing, artificial intelligence in English soccer. What's going on there?
Yeah, they're going to be using a semi-automated offsides technology for the first time in one of the rounds of the FA Cup in March. And they've been testing this out for a while. Basically, the AI would tell you if a player is offsides or not. And it's not really an issue of accuracy. You know, the refs get it right. The AI gets it right. It's a question of speed. And, you know, soccer games can just drag on. And then these things result in more stoppage time at the end. If they can get this to work, they're saying it's going to cut off an average of 31 seconds for each call.
I think if they put a chip in the footballs in the National Football League, you would be able to know exactly where the ball landed, and the question about is it a first down or not is so random. Where does the official place it when they march the chains out? Are they marching in a straight line? As critical as that is to the game,
mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me how unscientific it is given the technology that's available.
It definitely can be. I mean, sometimes I feel like it's, you know, they go by how many players point when someone's offside or,
yeah.
You know, they're trying to reach, you know, you have that, you know, little shove when you're at fourth and one, the tush push. But, you know, it's new technology and, you know, just getting things right and getting them faster because all sports events just seem to go on for too long because you know, the more you try to get it right, the longer it drags things out.
It's very frustrating, too, when everybody at home can see what the accurate call is, and those guys with the hood don't seem to be able to get it at least as quickly as we do. I appreciate your note about just getting it right more quickly. Bree Fowler is a senior writer at CNET.com. Thank you, Bree.
Great to be with you.
The recurring theme on this show has been back to work, in the office all the time, hybrid, still get to stay at home. Who's happy? Who's productive? Who's in? Who's out? Here's another version of that. Aki Ito, the chief correspondent at Business Insider, joins us again on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Aki.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
Okay, you start. What's the direction of this version of that story?
Sure. So, you know, return to office has, you know, kind of dominated the headlines for the last 2 years or so. And it really feels like we're all having to go back into the office. You know, earlier this year, Amazon employees started going back into the office 5 days a week. AT&T workers started doing that. And J.P. Morgan also announced that it's revoking the hybrid privileges of about half of its workforce. So now everyone has to go into the office as well. So it just feels like we're moving towards this office direction. But when you actually look at, like, the best available data on this, it shows that, like, America's prevalence of work from home actually hasn't changed that much over the last 2 years. It's kind of plateaued at a level that remains still pretty high compared to what we were seeing before the pandemic.
Okay, so we are, all of this chatter notwithstanding, enough people evidently are still at home. You say the number seems to have leveled off, although we haven't factored in yet because we can't. But at some point, if millions of federal employees have to go back to the office, I suppose that number will change a little bit. But what kind of numbers are you looking at?
Yeah, so there's this one survey that's compiled by a few economists, including Nick Bloom, who's an economist at Stanford. He's the best expert on work from home out there. And according to his survey, the prevalence of working from home in the U.S. Has been around, like, you know, between like 25% and 30% of all work days in America. That's a bit of a mouthful, but basically it means that about a quarter of any day that Americans spend working is done from home.
And how does that compare to 2019? It was about that during 2019 as well, right?
Yeah, in 2019 it was less than 5%, which is remarkable. So we've seen a remarkable increase, you know, since the onset of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big story here. It feels like we're going backwards, you know, because, you know, we certainly were working from home more at the peak of the pandemic in, let's say, like late 2020. But when you compare it to the days before the pandemic, we're still working from home so much more than we used to.
Well, my spin on that, based on what you just told us, is that I think work from home is a thing that we should have had with greater frequency before the pandemic. And I also think that a lot gets accomplished at the office, at the school, at the place. So we should be back as much as we need to be, but it doesn't need to be at the level it once was. So I get the let's get back into the office more often thing, but I hope a residual takeaway from all of this is that working from home is an accommodation employees should have, and it doesn't kill the company. So if what you're saying holds, or heck, if we just maintain a number above 5%, we will have learned something from all of this, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the important things we've realized, you know, going through this experiment over the last, gosh, how many years has it been? 4 years? 5 years.
It'll be five in March.
Five.
Yeah,
it's been a long while. That's given us a lot of data, a lot of experience. And I think perhaps the biggest lesson is that it really depends on the kind of job you have. You know, the more collaboration is required in your job, the more you have to work with other people, probably going into the office makes a little bit more sense, at least some of the time. But if you have a role that's pretty independent, you don't necessarily need to. And so I think companies are learning more and more that they kind of need to, you know, it depends on the function, even within the same company.
Here's how your article at Business Insider began. I'm reading Aki Ito to Aki Ito and you. How excited are you about your job these days? If you're feeling pretty blah, you're right in line with most of your colleagues. Every year, Gallup surveys tens of thousands of Americans about their jobs, and the latest results reveal an exceptionally bummed out workforce. Only 31% were engaged at work last year, the grouchiest reading in a decade. You and I have just talked about where they're working. Talk a little bit about how content people are about their work.
Yeah, they're very upset for sure, very unmotivated. And the people who are most unmotivated now actually happens to be the youngest workers who are under 35, which is a huge surprise because young people traditionally are a lot more excited and enthusiastic about their jobs than, you know, people who've been in the workforce for many decades. Now that's flipped. And, you know, my story is about how that really signals that there's something really wrong going on in the American workplace right now.
And to what do you attribute that? Why are young workers disenchanted, besides maybe the workplace? What else is happening here?
Yeah, so I think there are a number of factors, but the biggest one that I wrote about in my story is, you know, just that I think young people have become so much more clear-eyed about what work can provide them and what work can't provide them. You know, for older generations, there was the prize of lifetime job security, for example, or the prestige of a corner office, that dream of climbing the corporate ladder. You know, for millennials, it was this idea that you could fulfill your true potential at work. But I think, you know, people in their 20s now, they see how that all turned out, that all of those dreams seem to be more of a mirage. And, you know, they're just not that naive. And so as a result, they feel like, kind of, what's the point?
Less of their identity is pinned to maybe where they work, it seems. You also mentioned AI is a factor in this. In what way?
Well, I think, you know, young people, according to many surveys I've seen, are much more worried about the impact that AI will have on job opportunities compared to people who are older. I think that leads to this feeling once again of like, you know, what's the point? If chatbots are going to take away my job, why put in all this effort to get better at it? I can understand that, you know, if you think that your job is going to, you know, your occupation itself is going to become obsolete in 5 years, you know, why spend so much time getting really good at it?
Okay. But I will also say this. I think there's a generation that may be older than the group you're describing who would just say, buck up, work hard, figure it out, stay in the system, or find a system that works for you. But this sounds a little self-defeatist, too, what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, we certainly don't want young people to sit around and mope and not do anything. You know, that doesn't sound productive. But I think the young people would say, you know, maybe it worked for you to endure, you know, the toxicities and the boringness of the workplace for 30 years. But I know it's not going to work for me. Like, I've seen so many other people, you know, spend so long at one company only to get laid off, you know, at the drop of a hat, like, you know, only to never advance because, you know, all these other people got these unfair advantages anyway. And so they're like, I don't want to even, you know, play into the, you know, I don't even want to play that game in the first place because I think it's rigged against me. And I think that's why, you know, so many of them are being called to entrepreneurship, for example, or at least side hustles. You know, they're dreaming of early retirement. There's this whole a movement called FIRE, which stands for Financial Independence Retire Early. So their dreams are, you know, now elsewhere. It's not really within the corporation anymore.
Chief Correspondent of Business Insider, businessinsider.com's the website is Aki Ito. Her latest, Gen Z is more fed up with their jobs and work than Gen X and baby boomers. Thanks, Aki.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Deere & Company says depressed farm spending and tariffs will put more pressure on its business this year. The company reported quarterly earnings and its stock is down after telling investors to expect another challenging year. Deere put its 2025 net income estimate between $5 and $5.5 billion. It expects North American sales to drop 30%, cites higher inflation and the risk of tariffs under President Trump as problematic. Tariffs on steel and aluminum have already been imposed, and retaliation by other countries could impact the demand for U.S. agricultural goods. That would further limit the purchasing power of farmers for Deere's iconic green tractors used for planting and harvesting. At midday, Deere's share slid more than 5%. A bill's been proposed in Springfield that would eliminate Illinois' property tax. Democratic State Representative Thaddeus Jones of Calumet City introduced the legislation to research the feasibility of eliminating property taxes no later than January 1, 2030. The bill would shift revenue generation to income taxes and/or mandate more spending cuts. A bill signed last year by the governor required the Department of Revenue to conduct a comprehensive review of the property tax system, but this legislation is more specific. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
More business news now. It's the business of food, and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and happy National Cheddar Cheese Day. But for now, we're talking about mozzarella and the story of how string cheese became a thing thanks to Baker Cheese Company in tiny St. Cloud, Wisconsin.
We actually initiated string cheese manufacturing in the upper Midwest. We were the first manufacturers of any substance of string cheese in the country.
That's Brian Baker, the fourth generation in the family cheese business.
And really the history of that is Francis,
Brian's grandfather,
went to visit relatives out in California in the mid-1970s, and they took him to a little shop, a little deli.
And what happened then comes after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Okay, back to the story from Brian Baker. His grandpa Francis is visiting in California.
This deli had this little operation in the back where they had some mozzarella cheese that they got. I think they actually made it themselves. And they would just hand stretch it and pull it, kind of like rope stick type of things. And my grandfather, he brought it back and we were making mozzarella anyway. And he just told his sons, my dad, my uncles, he goes, I think we could do this and maybe be able to sell it retail around our community.
Grandpa knew what he was talking about.
And they just started hand stretching it and kind of making different shapes out of it and kind of came to the fact that a cylinder shape seemed to be the best with it.
Yeah, those cylinders became a huge business.
Now making 50 million pounds in a year.
And it's pure Wisconsin.
We bring our own milk in, we make it, we stretch it, cut it, brine it, package it. We do the whole thing at our plant.
Well, if I may, Brian, on behalf of parents and grandparents for whom string cheese is a healthy soother for kids in the back seat, thank you.
I love it.
But the Baker family doesn't make it anymore. A few years ago, they decided to sell their business to another family.
The Gentine family that owns Sargento, their company is just down the road from us. We've known them a long time and ultimately came that this was the best decision for the plant, the operation, the family, everything.
On the food calendar, along with National Cheddar Day, it's National Tortellini Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of string cheese on 720 WGN.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about pizza because this time of year, everybody's jonesing for a heart-shaped one. Joining us is Giovanni Labate. He is the owner of Tivoli Pizza Bar. It's I Love It spelled backwards. It's relatively new at Palatine. Giovanni, this is Sean Williams. Welcome to the show.
Sean, how you doing?
Good. Tell me about your pizza. Yours is kind of a New York style, right?
Yeah, we make a New York artisan pizza here at Tivoli, and we also do a Sicilian style, and we just recently introduced Detroit style pizza as well.
Oh, okay. So not a deep dish, though, not the Chicago style, huh?
No, we'll let the Chicago pizza places do that.
That's probably a good business decision. I mean, you can do whatever you want, but it seems to me like there's enough of that, and it seems like the thinner crust is really a trend right now anyway.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that's what makes us stand apart from everybody else, is that we're actually making different pizzas than your local pizza shop here in the area.
This is your second anniversary. What were you all doing before this, or why, or how did you get into the business?
Well, basically, I've been born into this business. My father was in the business for, you know, probably about 40 years. And, you know, basically, my first day I was born, my mom brought me into the restaurant business, and we've been in it since then.
I see. So this is your business now, though. You've opened up your own place in Palatine?
Correct, yes. We've been here for 2 years. Come tomorrow.
Yeah.
On Valentine's Day.
How about that? To mark your anniversary, I know you're doing a giveaway. Somebody's going to win a pizza a week for a year. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. We're going to give a nice little prize away for celebrating our two-year anniversary. It'll be a free pizza for a year, one pizza per week.
I stop in and drop my name off, and then I'm in the running. Is that right?
That's it.
What's the best? You do more than just pizza there, though, too, right?
Oh, yeah. We do a variety of pastas. We make our own gluten-free pasta as well, sandwiches, paninis, salads. All our desserts are homemade here in-house. So 99% of the menu is made here in-house.
You're going to that World Pizza Championships, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, we're excited. Hopefully, come April 4th, we'll be shipped to going off to Italy and compete in the World Pizza Champions.
Now, there's also, I'm reading here, an International Pizza Expo and Conference in Las Vegas. You're going to go to that?
Yeah, so luckily, a couple weeks before, we'll be going to Vegas to the Pizza Expo, and there's also a competition there. So hopefully, we'll come home with a win here in USA and then go to Italy and win one over there as well.
So what do you cook your pizza there and then somebody eats it and it's like a wine tasting, you get a score, that sort of thing?
Well, they kind of judge you on a lot of different areas, you know, obviously how it's baked, how it looks, creativity. There's different divisions. So it really does come down to it. They have a great panel of judges that, you know the pizza game, and you know, it's a tough competition because you're going against some of the best in the country.
I know you're in the Best Bites for Bounce competition, supporting the Bounce Children's Foundation, a nonprofit that transforms the lives of chronically ill kids. That's going to be February 21st. Steve Dolinsky, hooray, is going to be the MC. BestBites2025.org is the website to get tickets for that. Just give me the headline on that. What am I going to do when I go there?
So there's going to be, I believe, 8 chefs. They're going to be creating some unique comfort food, a little bit more upscale. And then you go around and see which everybody will vote on, what's their best bite. Hopefully it'll be us.
Yeah, no kidding. That's going to be at the Telegram Lounge at the old post office on Van Buren. What if, boy, I could get into that. BestBites2025.org. And in Palatine, Tivoli Pizza Bar is celebrating a 2-year anniversary tomorrow. Well, congratulations, Giovanni. Our best to everybody over there.
Thank you very much.